Hello, this is Jennifer bringing you the Christian Science Monitor, and thank you for joining us today for the Illinois Radio Readers International News. Today I will have mostly short excerpts from the Christian Science Monitor of November 7th, 2016. We'll start with a short article called, Today I'll be reading mostly shorter selections from the November 7th issue of the Christian Science Monitor, starting with Boris Yeltsin's divisive legacy. Did Russia's first president destroy a nation or set its course? Yekaterinburg, Russia. Russia has only one presidential library so far, a cavernous glass and steel structure that was originally designed to be a shopping mall. In front of it stands a tall white marble obelisk, reputed to be the only monument in Russia that requires around-the-clock police protection. Welcome to the Yeltsin Presidential Center, dedicated to this Ural Industrial Center's most famous native son, Boris Yeltsin. Few things get Russians hot under the collar faster than Yeltsin and the stormy transition he presided over in the 1990s. The legacy of Russia's first president includes negotiating the demise of the former Soviet Union and introducing sweeping reforms that gave Russians unprecedented freedom. But those reforms triggered mass poverty, and Yeltsin also oversaw the shelling of his own parliament building during a desperate 1993 power struggle, a war on separatist Chechnya, and the drafting of a president-centered constitution that Vladimir Putin has used to impose a near-authoritarian regime. Depending on whom you ask, the Yeltsin era was either the best of times or the worst of times. It was the spring of hope, or it was the winter of despair. Few express much ambivalence about it. But for some, merely having the debate over Yeltsin's legacy shows the social and political changes that Russia ushered in during his term. We have regular open forums here where we debate all these issues. It can get pretty heated, says Dina Sorokina, the Yeltsin Center's youthful, energetic director. I would point out that this is one of the few places in our country where a diversity of views is welcomed and encouraged. Since the center was opened almost a year ago, it's hosted almost 250,000 visitors in its Museum of 1990s History and has become a fixture on Yekaterinburg's cultural scene by sponsoring a wide range of artistic and theatrical events. There have also been protests, including an attack that badly defaced the Yeltsin Monument while the center was being constructed. But the idea of the center enjoys wide support from Russia's establishment. More than half of its approximately $200 million cost was provided by the Kremlin, the rest by private donations raised from a who's who of Russia's business world. Its inauguration last year was attended by Mr. Putin, whose government has been making major efforts to smooth over Russia's wildly contradictory historical record and present it as a single unbroken narrative. The Kremlin has openly catered to growing Soviet nostalgia, sponsored a huge Moscow museum devoted to Tsarist history, and, in Yekaterinburg, promoted lavish memorials to the last Tsar, who was murdered here in 1918. This center is not just about one man, says Ms. Sorokina. It's about the hopes and aspirations of Russians and their search for higher ideals. The museum presents Russia's thousand-year story as an unending struggle for freedom, which often suffered terrible setbacks, but culminated in Yeltsin's defeat of a hardline communist coup in 1991, which led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Understandably, given the center's funding, there is no attempt to assess whether the subsequent Putin era represents a setback. For some, the arrival of Putin, handed power by an ailing Yeltsin on New Year's Eve 1999, signaled the end of Russia's democratic experiment. The gradual imposition of a stifling neo-Soviet blanket over basic freedoms, and the resumption of geopolitical strife with the West. Others view Putin as a savior who reversed the Yeltsin-inspired disintegration of Russia's historically powerful state, renounced destructive Western economic advice, delivered mass prosperity, and made Russia a great power again. Yeltsin was a pure destroyer. He brought down the USSR, ruined the economy, wrecked our armed forces, and groveled to the West, says Vasily Rafikov, a retired police officer. This center is not just a waste of money. It's an insult to millions of honest Russians who worked and fought for the Soviet Union and then were cast aside by Yeltsin's so-called New Russia. Dmitry Kozalev, editor of the Yekaterinburg branch of Russia's popular Zinak.ru online newspaper, and who came of age in the Putin era, says the painful years of transition under Yeltsin probably cleared the way for the relative prosperity Russians have enjoyed under Putin. They also brought about many positive social and political changes that cannot be put back into the box. We went through a mostly peaceful transition from socialism to capitalism, and people today are very different from their parents. Russia is not the Soviet Union and never will be again, he says. We owe that to Boris Yeltsin and all we endured in the 1990s. The message I get when I visit the Yeltsin Center is that we don't need authoritarianism to have a better life. Yeltsin showed us that this country is a work in progress, and it's never finished. In India, an Uber model for tractors. Smartphone app gives farmers better access to big machinery. An Indian company has adopted an Uber-like business plan to solve a problem for many Indian farmers: lack of access to inexpensive tractors. It used to be that renting a tractor subjected a farmer to discriminatory treatment from equipment. It used to be that renting a tractor subjected a farmer to discriminatory treatment from equipment owners. Prices could be hiked up during high demand periods. Mahindra and Mahindra, a major Indian vehicle manufacturer, decided to ease access by creating a tractor rental app for farmers. The problem the company tackled is not just one of convenience, but of access and poverty. More than 850 million Indians live in rural areas, and nearly 60% of them are farmers, many of little means. Compounding the situation are unpredictable rainfall and rising temperatures from global warming. Technology to help with irrigation and pest control adds to cash-strapped farmers' economic burden. Many Indian farmers have in the past pooled funds to buy machinery to share. Agriculture in these parts is not just a livelihood, it's a way of life. Harpreet Singh, a farmer in the village of Birnaraya, told a Monitor reporter 2 years ago. While there are many aspects of the agriculture system that farmers and experts say the government should address, the tractor rental solution would bring an immediate sense of relief to farmers. Through the smartphone app Tringo, released in September, farmers can request a tractor. They can also contact a call center by phone. The rental cost is between 400 and 700 rupees, about $6 to $10, per hour. Buying a new tractor in India costs at least 3.2 million rupees, about $48,000. The app is now being rolled out across India. The company plans to expand its rentals to harvesters and rice planters. costly machines that farmers need only a few times a year. When a dog is not a dog in Malaysia. Chain restaurant is asked to rename a hot dog so it's halal. Malaysians may soon find the familiar pretzel dog removed from the menu of U.S. fast food chain Auntie Anne's, but the change is likely to be made in name only. The decision was made by local Islamic authorities concerned that Muslim customers may not realize pretzel dogs contain no dog meat, so they can consume them without violating Islamic dietary laws. To obtain the official halal certification, which identifies food prepared according to Islamic dietary laws, the restaurant must remove dog from the pretzel dog's name and maybe replace it with sausage. In Islam, dogs are considered unclean and the name cannot be related to halal certification. Sirajuddin Suhaimi, director of the government's Malaysian Islamic Development Department, told the BBC. While Mr. Suhaimi says the ruling was a result of complaints from Muslim tourists, some Malaysian citizens and politicians see the move as backward. Muslim-majority Malaysia has always prided itself as practicing a moderate form of the religion, but conservative attitudes have been on the rise in the past few years, reflecting a struggle between modern and traditional interpretations of Islam. Hot dog has always been known to be a Western food. It comes from the English language. Please do not make us seem stupid and backward, said Tourism and Culture Minister Datuk Seri Nasri Aziz, as reported by Malay Mail Online. Even in Malay, it's called a hot dog. I've been around for... It's been around for so many years. I'm a Muslim, and I'm not offended. I'm not offended at all. Other Malaysians took to social media and complained that the ruling made them look stupid. Marina Mahathir, daughter of a former Malaysian prime minister, joked on Facebook that, "We are poor, easily confused Muslims who have never heard of hot dogs before." The Federation of Malaysian Consumer Associations and the Muslim Consumers Association of Malaysia, however, stand by the ruling, stating that restaurateurs and food producers should be mindful of sensitivities of Muslims and avoid certain words. Other Western food products that have received similar treatment in the country include A&W root beer. Muslims are prohibited from consuming alcohol. The popular soda was renamed RB in 2013, to remove any confusion about the fact that this beer is non-alcoholic. Next, we have the Points of Progress section, a weekly global roundup, starting with Yosemite. An endangered frog in Yosemite National Park is rebounding. The Sierra Nevada yellow-legged frog was one of The Sierra Nevada yellow-legged frog was once one of the most abundant amphibians in that western mountain range, but the animal has disappeared from 93% of its historical range. Efforts to improve conditions have proved remarkably successful, however, and the frog population has increased sevenfold in Yosemite over the past two decades. Although the measures employed, which include removing non-native predatory fish, are easier within the national park, they nonetheless provide a template for preserving other ecosystems. In Colombia, peace talks are to begin with another rebel group, in spite of the people's vote against the agreement reached with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. Beginning October 7th in Quito, Ecuador, the Colombian government will meet with representatives of the National Liberation Army, the country's other main left-wing guerrilla group. Informal talks began 3 years ago in Caracas, Venezuela, but fighting continues, with the Colombian army killing one rebel and capturing four others in mid-October. Yet authorities pursued the same strategy with FARC, refusing to cease combat operations until a deal was reached. In China, Chinese cities are striving to cut emissions, with some looking to reduce their effect on the climate before the national target date of 2030. Urban areas such as Beijing, Chengdu, and Qingdao are employing various strategies in pursuit of this goal, including turning sludge into energy, an initiative that aims to reduce greenhouse gases, water pollution, and solid waste, produce compressed natural gas and organic compost, and save money. The Ministry of Housing and Urban Rural Development has endorsed the approach and is encouraging other cities to adopt it. Other schemes gaining traction include a congestion charge to reduce traffic and raise money for improving public transport, and low-carbon development, combining cuts in emissions with continued economic growth. In London, cyclists are being prioritized as the city's mayor, Sadiq Khan, announced that tens of thousands of trucks will be banned from the city's streets to better safeguard cyclists' safety. Poor visibility for the drivers of certain kinds of trucks means that such vehicles are involved in more than half of all cycling deaths in the capital, as well as more than a fifth of pedestrian fatalities. Trucks will now be given a rating based on the amount of vision the driver has. By 2024, those with less than 3 out of 5 stars will be banned. I'm not prepared to stand by and let dangerous lorries continue to cause further heartbreak and tragedy on London's roads, says Mr. Khan. And in the ocean, jellyfish could help fight fraud by assisting in tracking the origin of marine catches, an important step in maintaining the integrity of protected areas and in building consumer confidence in labeling. Accurate and practical methodology is hard to come by, but in a new study, scientists considered chemical variation in jellyfish, scallops, and herring, a record that provides insight into where they find their food and what part of the ocean they inhabit. The maps scientists were able to construct of chemical variation throughout the North Sea proved accurate in predicting where animals originated, paving the way for similar work involving other species. Africa's emerging female politicians. Women's political representation is growing, but what of equality? Johannesburg, South Africa. If you could choose any country in the world in which to be born a girl, Mozambique might not top your list. Nearly one in every two girls in the Southern African country is married before the age of 18, and more women die in childbirth there than in almost any other country in the world. Neither would you likely choose Rwanda, where only 41% of girls will finish secondary school, or Uganda, which has almost 40 times the rate of teenage pregnancy as Switzerland or the Netherlands. But by at least one measure of gender equality, these African countries are the world's undisputed leaders. Each has a national legislature that is more than one-third female, outpacing the United States, Canada, most of Europe, and the vast majority of everywhere else, too. Rwanda, indeed, has a greater percentage of women in its parliament, 64, than any other nation. Globally, 9 of the 25 countries with the most women in their parliaments are in sub-Saharan Africa. That's important symbolically, but it's also women politicians who put gender equality issues on the legislative agenda, says Drew Dahlerup, a Danish-Swedish academic who founded the Quota Project, a database of parliamentary gender quotas around the world. Over the past 2 decades, Africa has been a huge success story in this regard. But if growing gender parity in politics is helping African women put equality on the docket, it's far from a social cure-all. In many countries, a yawning gap between women's political representation and basic measures of their quality of life, how many girls finish school, how many mothers die in childbirth, the prevalence of child marriage, also raises important questions about the limits of female political muscle in transforming a society. The representation of women is one thing, having the policies to make change is another, and implementing those policies is something else still, says Nahashan Alawoka, the East and South African Advocacy and Campaigns Director for the non-governmental organization Save the Children, which on October 11th released its ranking of the world's best and worst places in the world to be a girl. The list takes into account 5 factors: early pregnancy rates, child marriage rates, girls' secondary school completion rates, maternal death ratios, and the representation of women in government. Like nearly every global quality of life ranking, the top of the class is blonde and blue-eyed, the same cluster of overachieving Scandinavian states that consistently outpace the rest of the world in nearly every measure of good societal health. Sweden is number one, followed by Finland and Norway. On the other end, seemingly consigned by history and poverty to be the planet's chronic underachievers, huddle an equally familiar group of African countries: Niger, Chad, Central African Republic, Somalia. But as Ms. Dahlerup notes, when looking for examples of societies attempting to rapidly transform their gender status quo, many of the worst performers on the Save the Children ranking become its leaders. In particular, post-conflict societies, of which Africa has an abundance, are often eager to rebuild their countries on equal footing and pass aggressive policies designed to accelerate that task. It took 100 years for Scandinavian countries to get where they are now in terms of political representation of women, Dahlerup says. In many African countries, on the other hand, the change has happened in 2 decades or less. Sometimes all it took was a single election. Senegal, for example, jumped from having a parliament that was 22.7% women to one that was 42.7% women in 2012. And Namibia's legislature went from 25.6% women before the 2015 election to 41.3% afterward. Patriarchal tendencies are still in existence, says Jennifer Vandenhever, a Namibian member of parliament and the first chairwoman of the opposition DTA party. But the proliferation of women in high places is starting to change the shape of the institution. It's pulling the scales to balance, she says. Continuing on, in the People Making a Difference section, we have: in San Francisco, Laura Slattery and Tina Christopher opened church doors to homeless people during the day. By Patricia Lee Brown. Tina Christopher's day begins at 5:45 a.m. as she cleans the sidewalk in front of St. Boniface Catholic Church in the Tenderloin, the once colorful vice district in San Francisco, now better known as a province of the poor, the desperate, the addicted, and the down and out. She picks up the food containers, the needles, the flattened bits of cardboard, and the wet shoes before making her daily announcement to an awaiting throng, some of them already asleep on the sidewalk. "All right, my beautiful brothers and sisters," Ms. Christopher says in her always chipper voice. "Good morning. Time to get up. Wakey, wakey." Then she unlocks the church's heavy iron gate. Soon, St. Boniface's 74 backmost pews will cradle some 150 homeless people seeking sacred sleep, the sound of snoring permeating the incense-filled room. Beneath the saints painted on the church's glittering dome, they stretch out for 9 hours of vital slumber, resting their heads on ad hoc sweatshirt and t-shirt pillows, or sometimes their folded hands. For a brief moment, their faces, beatific and baby-like in sleep, do not betray the nights of fearful wandering and the way concrete seeps into a person's bones and stays there. Christopher is the program director of the Gubbio Project, a pioneering effort, believed to be the country's first, that brings new meaning to the word sanctuary. Co-founded in 2004 by the Reverend Luis Vital, a well-known peace and human rights advocate, the program provides a place for homeless people to sleep during the daylight hours, when most shelters are closed. The project is named after Gubbio, the Italian town where, the story goes, residents befriended a wolf after realizing the animal wasn't dangerous, just hungry. The project's guiding lights are two women who are devoted to the dignity of the people they call guests. Laura Slattery, Gubbio's executive director and public voice, is a West Point graduate turned social justice activist who wears jeans and hiking boots and exudes a sense of calm resolve, even in a crisis. Christopher is the exuberant all-hands-on-deck ground commander who knows the name of every guest and whose finely tuned antennae swiftly intuit their needs and issues. They are each other's yin and yang, and both women have led lives with elaborate twists and turns. "Tina shows me what fierce, loving action is," says Ms. Slattery. "She's real and in the moment." Christopher says, "I learn from Laura's temperament. I'm very emotional. She grounds me." Together, they work on the front lines of this Nouveau Dickensian city. One, a place of artisanal oysters and $750 sneakers. The other, a crisis zone ruled by grim mathematics. Roughly 7,000 homeless people and 1,200 shelter beds. The swelling number of unhoused neighbors, as Slattery calls them, has prompted Gubbio to add a second location at the Episcopal Church of St. John the Evangelist in the city's Mission District. The two churches provide respite for some 300 homeless people a day. San Francisco's severe lack of affordable housing makes the project a critical undertaking, says Bob Erlenbusch, the board chairman of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Laura has this beautiful, centered approach to folks that immediately puts them at ease, says Jennifer Friedenbach, executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. That's a large reason why there is such a peaceful atmosphere at Gubbio. She's committed for real to this fundamental human right, sleep for folks who get very little. Sleep deprivation can exacerbate the many mental and physical health issues that often accompany homelessness, from high blood pressure to irritability. The very concept of sleeping on the street is a misnomer, since most homeless people, fearing victimization, are constantly on guard, and thus sleep fitfully, if at all, says Dr. Barry Zevin, medical director of street medicine and shelter health for the San Francisco Department of Public Health. The Gubbio Project gives people who aren't normally seen a sense that they are cared about as human beings, he says. At St. Boniface, Christopher is in constant motion, eyeglasses perched atop her head, dispensing cough drops, rubber bands, tampons, shaving cream, and other necessities from a converted confessional. She makes it a point to ask guests whether they'd prefer a pink toothbrush or a blue one, a black blanket or a brown one. Even the simplest things are important to people who don't have choices, she explains. Socks and other staples come from volunteers like Roberta Snyder, who has established relationships with housekeepers at nearby hotels and provides soaps, shampoos, and other items discarded by guests. Like a good parent, Christopher is loving but firm. She notices a new haircut. "I didn't recognize you." A nice outfit. "You're quite the matchy-matchy." Or when someone is struggling with pain. "Carol, did you get to the doctor?" she asks a woman who has an infected toe from a puncture wound. She comforts the man retching into a trash can, the older woman who is sobbing because her partner is missing, and she moves quickly to squash confrontations. If they persist, next time it's adios, she says. Drug use or displaying a weapon is strictly prohibited. Anthony Robertson, who says he has paranoid schizophrenia, calls Christopher a people person. "It's not just about keeping the supplies out," he observes. "It's the kind word. Whether she has traveled down the same roads as some of us or not so, it's almost like she was sent here." Christopher has indeed traveled down some of the same roads. She grew up outside San Francisco with hard-working, attentive parents who would tell her, "Whatever you do, be the best, even if it's shoveling poop." "I can't tell you where I went wrong," she says. In her mid-20s, Christopher began experimenting with drugs for fun, but the fun became a physical dependency, prompting her to live on the streets and landing her in jail twice, including 2 years at a state prison. She entered an addiction and employment program and went to school to be a drug and alcohol counselor. A friend worked at St. Boniface, and in 2011 Christopher began volunteering 3.5 hours a week, then more. "For me it was a calling," she explains. Slattery's path to Gubbio, too, was circuitous. She grew up outside Los Angeles and was bullied as a young girl for being cross-eyed, a condition for which she had surgery at age 7. "Kids can be mean," she notes. The experience would have a lasting effect. "For me, it was instrumental, reminding me about judging by appearances," she says. The father of a high school classmate suggested West Point, where she was recruited for basketball. Her intention was to become a doctor, and in photographs, she looks every bit the proud 2nd Lieutenant, 25th Infantry Division. But she discovered that her heart wasn't in the military, which led Slattery on a theological and spiritual journey toward nonviolence. She met Father Vital, whom she calls a modern-day St. Francis, and joined him in numerous protests, including a well-publicized incident in which she hung her Army battle-dress jacket on the chain-link fence of what was then the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, and was promptly arrested. Her protest walk with colleagues from Oakland, California, to a federal prison 30 miles away, where she served 3 months, was front-page news. "One becomes invisible," she says of incarceration. She worked in El Salvador, Mexico, and elsewhere for a Franciscan peace organization, before grounding herself further at Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. Her myriad experiences have given her a deep feeling for the powerless. Giovanna Tanzio, a volunteer who makes 65 breakfast sandwiches with gourmet ingredients for guests, recalls a recent incident at St. John's in which a homeless man collapsed with an epileptic seizure. "Laura was the one on the ground with him," she says. "It's not just a job for her. She loves these people. She has a Franciscan soul." Slattery was there at 6 on a recent morning, the guests fast asleep on donated inflatable relief beds in the pewless sanctuary. She gently intervened in a spat involving a keyed-up woman veteran using a stance learned at West Point. The woman soon apologized. "That's okay," Slattery told her. "I'm a vet, too." She thinks of the Gubbio Project as the Ministry of Presence, one that dispels some popular myths about homeless people along the way. Quite a number of donations to Gubbio's $350,000 annual budget, for instance, are made by guests. "Last week it was $42, Slattery says. "The week before it was $24. Flips the idea of panhandling on its head, right?" And that's it for today. This has been Jennifer reading the Christian Science Monitor, which we present each weekday at 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. on the Illinois Radio Reader. Until next time, have a great day.